On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about a statewide investigation led by the Wisconsin Department of Justice to review reports of clergy abuse and other people in positions of trust within the church going back decades. The Catholic Archdiocese of Milwaukee filed for bankruptcy 10 years ago. In 2015, it reached a $21 million settlement for hundreds of victims of sexual abuse by clergy. What questions do you have for Attorney General Josh Call about the state's investigation of abuse by Catholic priests and other faith leaders? What do you want to know? 800-642-1234 to join in. Attorney General Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the question is why? Why is DOJ doing this investigation of clergy across Wisconsin?
You know, this isn't something that we've undertaken lightly, Kate. It's something we gave very serious thought to as we decided to do this. But there are a few reasons that we think it's vital that this review take place. One is there has not been a statewide review of clergy and faith leader abuse in Wisconsin. And this is an opportunity to have that review conducted so that we can get a full picture of what's taken place, and we can get some measure of accountability. But it's also important that we connect survivors with victim services and that we're making sure that support is available for those survivors, and that we make sure that we are preventing future cases from happening and hopefully able to make recommendations about how different dioceses or religious orders can improve their reporting processes.
But what do you say to the critique that this was addressed in Wisconsin courts years ago? The Archdiocese of Milwaukee filed for bankruptcy. $21 million went to survivors of abuse, $500,000 for victim therapy.
Well, first of all, that's just the Milwaukee Archdiocese. We're doing a statewide review. And there hasn't been a statewide review that's been done. It also hasn't been done by a Wisconsin government agency. And one of the things that we've heard from survivors of clergy and faith leader abuse is that having an independent review done and having it done in a statewide fashion can really help not only bring accountability, but help bring healing for survivors.
Do you think that local law enforcement are not equipped to do these investigations or trained to investigate abuse by faith leaders? Why not do this at the local level?
This is really a statewide and even broader issue, and that's why we think the Wisconsin Department of Justice is the right agency to lead this. But that being said, we are coordinating with different agencies. We are working with the DAs in the five counties where the five dioceses are located in Wisconsin. But there are some unusual aspects to this. One is that, you know, we know that a number of the cases that are at issue here are cases that in some instances happened years ago. And we expect that there will be some cases that are outside the statute of limitations. In fact, we think most of the cases will be outside of the statute of limitations. But that doesn't mean that we can't do a lot of good for survivors by conducting this review, even if a prosecution can't be brought, because we can still work to make sure that there's some measure of accountability, like encouraging different dioceses and religious orders to make sure that their lists of credibly accused priests are accurate, and also, again, connecting survivors with services and making recommendations for changes that can be made to prevent future cases.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the state's investigation of the Catholic Church with Attorney General Josh Call. You can join in. What questions do you have for the Attorney General about this investigation? What do you want to know? How do you see this in your community? Have you been wanting to report abuse in the church? Join in at 800-642-1234. Attorney General, a spokesperson for the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, questioned the need for this and whether this would re-traumatize survivors. What do you think of that?
Our Office of Crime Victim Services at the Wisconsin Department of Justice is the leading statewide agency for victim services. And one of the things that was really important to us as we prepared this initiative was to do it in a way that was victim-centric, and where we were making sure that we were helping victims of clergy and faith leader abuse. And one of the things that we've done is we've set up a reporting process that victims can use where they can report to a trusted, safe victim services specialist. So we've got an opportunity here for people to really move forward with healing. And the victim services specialist, as well as the survivors of clergy abuse, who we've been speaking to, have been very supportive of this initiative. By making services available and getting accountability, we're going to, we believe, do a lot of good for survivors of clergy abuse. And so I think the concerns that have been raised are ones that are really important to think about. But we have thought about them very seriously and think that this is going to be helpful to survivors.
Can you talk more about what the role of the victim services specialist is and how that works?
This is an area where there's been significant progress made over a number of years in the criminal justice system, recognizing the importance of providing services to victims of crime and making sure that people are able to help heal. What we've done is set up a hotline where survivors of clergy abuse are encouraged to report, and anybody with information about clergy and faith leader abuse is encouraged to report. When people contact that hotline, which they can do either online or by calling up a telephone number, they'll be connected with victim services specialists who are trained in providing support to survivors of sexual assault. This is an opportunity, again, for people to report to somebody who is trained and who is a safe person to report to and who can connect survivors with local victim services specialists.
You were elected in 2018 after Pennsylvania had released its report identifying hundreds of priests accused of molesting children. Why did it take this long for a launch of a statewide investigation by DOJ here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, like I said early on, this isn't something that we undertook lightly. We wanted to make sure that if we were to conduct this type of review, that we were doing it in a way that would be a significant service to survivors of clergy and faith leader abuse. We also had the opportunity to look at what other states have done. A number of other states have launched similar reviews, and we wanted to assess what we thought was effective in other states and things that we might want to do differently here than what other states did. We also want to make sure that we had the resources in place at the Wisconsin Department of Justice to launch this initiative in a way where we could respond to contacts from survivors. And so what we've done based on all of that is set up a review that really has two key components. One is we are reaching out to dioceses and religious orders in Wisconsin to ask them to provide documents about cases of clergy and faith leader abuse. But secondly, we've set up the hotline I mentioned, and your listeners can contact that with information by calling either 1-877-222-2620 or going online to supportsurvivors.widoj.gov. And through those reports, we expect to get significant information about what's happened here. We feel that this is going to be an effective process at getting a full picture of the information, but it's critical that people reach out with information and contact that hotline.
We have Attorney General Josh Call on the line explaining the Justice Department's statewide probe it launched last month of clergy sex abuse and misconduct. Do you support the Attorney General launching an investigation of the Catholic Church over abuse by priests? What do you think of it? Should Wisconsin lift the statute of limitations on cases involving sexual abuse of minors? Join in 800-642-1234. Back with more State Cap in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It's a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the State Justice Department launching an independent review of reports of clergy and faith leader abuse in Wisconsin. As we've been talking about, there are five Catholic dioceses in our state, along with several religious orders with priests in Wisconsin. The DOJ also launched a hotline and website to receive information directly from survivors and their families. Do you support the Attorney General in this probe of the Catholic Church? What is your thinking? Join in 800-642-1234. And Attorney General Josh Call is with us for 10 more minutes. We heard from George, called in from Minocqua, couldn't stay with us, and says this topic is important, but George feels the Attorney General is focusing on the Catholic Church. There are also priests doing this in other sects. Are you aware of this, George asks? Are there plans to address this?
We're very intentional in referring to this as clergy and faith leader abuse, because we want to make sure that we're making clear to people that we want to receive information relating to abuse, not only by priests, but also by other leaders in the Catholic Church, such as teachers or nuns, but also leaders of other faiths, and also any evidence of abuse, and in particular institutional concealment from groups that are not faith groups. Anybody who has information about sexual assault, and especially if it's sexual assault in an institutional setting where there's potential concerns of concealment, we want to encourage those folks to contact us. And if we receive that information, if it's a case where we think it's appropriate for there to be further criminal investigation and perhaps prosecution, we will work with local law enforcement. And if it's a historical case and there's reason to believe that there's a value in doing a significant review as we are right now with the Catholic Church, then we'll do that as well.
So what I'm hearing from you is that this is wider and broader than the Catholic Church alone.
Our initial outreach and request for documents is to Catholic dioceses and religious orders, but the hotline that we have set up is available for anybody to contact with information about sexual assault. And if we get information that indicates that there's reason to conduct a review of any other institution, or we get information about cases where we can refer that to local law enforcement, we're going to do that.
Let's go to Marcus now in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What are your thoughts?
So I was born, raised, confirmed Catholic, went to a fantastic church. The priest was amazing as a human being, as a preacher, as a leader. However, that being said, if there are improprieties that have occurred, I think that it is necessary to pursue those, because as the Bible states, that which occurs in the dark must be brought to the light. And so I think if there is wrongdoing, then absolutely pursue it.
Marcus, thank you. Attorney General.
Well, thanks for that comment, Marcus. One of the things that we're hoping is that the diocese and religious orders that we've reached out to are going to work with us as we conduct this review, because it is in everyone's interests to make sure that we have a full accounting of the facts as to what happened, and make sure that we're connecting survivors with services, and ultimately putting in place and making sure that there are in place processes that will ensure that when there is reporting, that it's handled appropriately, and that we can work to prevent future cases.
We're talking with Attorney General Josh Call, who oversees the Department of Justice, as we discuss the investigation into the Catholic Church. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's look at statute of limitations for a moment. What is the goal here of reviewing cases that may no longer be prosecuted under state law due to the statutes?
Yeah, there are a few things I'd mention there, Kate. First, the way that the statute of limitations works can be complicated in different cases. And so there may be some cases that are older, but for various reasons may not be barred from prosecution by the statute of limitations. So one thing we want to make sure we're doing is gathering the facts so that if there are cases that can be investigated and ultimately prosecuted within the statute of limitations, that we're not missing those cases, so that we're getting criminal accountability where possible. But even in cases where the statute of limitations will bar a prosecution, one of the things we've heard from survivors of clergy and faith leader abuse is that having a full statewide review and some measure of accountability, even if it's not a prosecution, is important. And so one way we think we can do that is by working with the diocese and religious orders to make sure that the published lists of credibly accused priests are accurate, but also connecting survivors with services so that they can get support if they need it and if they want it, also is going to help provide a real service to survivors. Because even though cases may have happened decades ago, that doesn't mean that survivors of clergy and faith leader abuse aren't still working through the trauma that goes with that. And if we can connect those folks with services, that's going to help make a positive impact.
One more quick thing here before we move on. What is the timeline? When do you expect this investigation to be completed?
We haven't set a specific timeline because there are a lot of different factors that can impact how long these processes take, but this is something that's going to take time. I mean, there are over 160 cases where the diocese and religious orders have identified priests as having been credibly accused of sexual assault. And so the document review process is going to take some time. And then it's also critical that we gather information through the hotline, and we're going to need to follow up on that information depending on what information we receive. So the process will take some time, but we want to make sure we're doing a thorough review here so that we can, again, work to address these goals we've been talking about, like getting greater accountability, connecting survivors with services, and making recommendations for process improvements to prevent future cases.
Moving on to your task force, looking at cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, they held their first meeting in December, a meeting in March, three more on the calendar this year. What progress is this task force making?
There are a few different things that the task force is focused on. One is we want to make sure we're raising awareness about this issue because, as we've been talking about, the disproportionate rates at which Indigenous women have gone missing or been murdered are really staggering, and identifying ways that we can address that problem, but also just drawing attention to it so others are focused on addressing it is critical. I think we've made significant progress in raising awareness of this issue, but there's certainly a lot more work to do. We've also, that task force has set up subcommittees. They're going to be working on a few different things. But one of the things that we want to do is bring law enforcement leaders, tribal government leaders, state government leaders together to figure out ways that they can work together more efficiently. And that's something that is an ongoing process. And then working to identify root causes and solutions to those root causes is critical. And so that process is underway. As we move forward with the task force, we hope to ultimately see suggestions from the subcommittees and from the task force as a whole as to how we can make improvements on those issues.
Looking at sexual assault kits, the state received a federal grant to create an evidence tracking system, and you said this will help prevent another backlog of untested kits. How does that work?
Right now, when a sexual assault kit is collected, it is sent from when a survivor reports, the kit is sent from the sexual assault nurse examiner to local law enforcement, and then it's sent to the crime labs for processing. But there's no centralized system that keeps track of all of the sexual assault kits around the state. And so if there is a point in that process where the kit is not submitted, say from the hospital to law enforcement or from law enforcement to the crime labs, we don't have a way at the state level of identifying that issue. And, as you know and have reported on, previously there had been thousands of kits that had gone unsubmitted.
Mm-hmm.
This will create a uniform statewide tracking system so we can see what's happening with every kit that's collected in the state. And if there are problems, we can identify them and reach out to the agency that has them and ask them to make sure the kit is submitted.
Okay, so there aren't any cracks or drops in the system and really tracking closely. Do you have enough funding, enough resources to operate a tracking system like this?
We do. The federal funds that are in place will allow us to procure the system that we need, and then we're going to be conducting training with agencies around the state to make sure it's in place. And once the system is up and running, we actually think it will be more efficient, because rather than having to do inventories or censuses of the kits around the state every several years, this will allow us to have up-to-date data and to find the information we need just by running a search on the data.
Attorney General, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Josh Call is Attorney General of Wisconsin. We have a link to the DOJ's Clergy and Faith Leaders Abuse website offering support for victims and survivors. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Coming up, the State Capitol Report continues with the chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. Ratepayers, we want to hear from you. What questions or pressing issues do you have in how utilities are regulated? What do you want to know from the PSC? 800-642-1234. We'll be back with more State Cap after a news update on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about issues related to utility regulation and how residential ratepayers are affected. In this fiscal year, the state has helped more than 41,000 eligible households pay their past due utility bills at risk of disconnection. It's about $22 million in federal energy assistance. That's according to a data report from the Wisconsin Home Energy Assistance Program. Have you fallen behind on your utility bills? How have you been managing? What assistance have you received? What is the state of broadband where you are? 800-642-1234 to join in. Rebecca Cameron Vaughk is chairperson of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. Commissioner Vaughk, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be back.
Well, the PSC, starting with broadband here, the PSC has awarded tens of millions of dollars in broadband grants over the past 8 years or so. And you're saying you estimate 400,000 residents lack broadband. Where are we at with this issue? Are we any further ahead on solving connectivity?
You know, I think we are. And I think what we've seen in terms of investment as it's ramped up over the last, 8 years has been that as we get out into the communities, we have a better understanding of who really is underserved. So in years past, we have relied on mapping data from the Federal Communications Commission, from the FCC. And what we have learned is that those numbers vastly understate the number of residents who either don't have any service at all or who don't have what is considered to be broadband service. So we're definitely making progress. There's a ways to go. As you indicated, we estimate that we still have about 400,000 residents that don't have the access that we need. But what we're seeing is, as the conversation around broadband increases and we're hearing more about it at the local level, we're coming up with some innovative ways to get at those last residents to ensure that they're getting connected. So, Governor Evers declared 2021 the year of broadband access, and that is a sort of a signal to underscore the fact that it's going to require strategic investments, but also things like a line extension grant program. We've heard from a number of residents who will call the PSC and they'll say, look, I'm looking at the internet service provider out my front window. They are laying fiber in the roadway, and I've asked them if they can connect my house, but they've told me just to come up the driveway, it's going to take $8,000. Mm-hmm. And so the grant program would be one way to help residents offset the cost in that type of a situation.
I'm wondering how you see the Biden administration's American Jobs Plan factoring into this, wanting to spend $100 billion on broadband and really prioritizing local governments and nonprofits and cooperatives rather than, larger private companies. How do you feel about that approach?
I mean, I think it's going to take all types of approaches for us to get 100% connectivity. So I think that that's a great place to start. I also know that at the local level, there isn't the technical expertise, and quite frankly, there just isn't enough staffing at the local level. So one of the recommendations that we've made is to have a broadband connector pilot and make planning grants available to local community leaders, local economic development corporations, because they know where the need is, right? They're kind of the boots on the ground, and they understand where the need is specifically in their community. What they need is they need to be connected to resources, both financial resources and technical resources, in order to make applications for grants or in order to be able to pull down those federal dollars. The Governor Evers has also been very clear that he has committed to using at least $200 million of federal dollars to get at broadband connectivity in Wisconsin.
So this broadband connector pilot would be kind of shepherding the process through in their own community. How would that work?
Exactly. So what we would do is, and we tried this out in 2020 as a pilot, and we had so many more interested applicants than we had available funding, which to me demonstrates the need for this type of assistance. So what we would do is the technical experts at the PSC would partner up with local community officials, and they would help them through the process of, here's where you go. You know, the first step is, have you identified a provider in your area? A lot of times what we hear from local community representatives is, I don't even know who the internet service provider is in my community.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very simple step one, where we can provide that assistance. We can provide that help and make those connections. And it's a way to help the local community representative who oftentimes wears more than one hat, right? They're oftentimes doing more than just one job. So this connectors pilot is a way to provide technical and financial assistance at the very local level.
Before we move on here, is there any talk about the PSC, you know, making broadband a public utility, folding it in with the other utilities?
You know, we haven't. I am anxiously awaiting to hear the final report from the Task Force on Broadband Connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
That report is due in June. One step that we have made is we had a suggestion that state law be rewritten to relax some of the requirements around a municipality from being able to provide broadband. So current law allows a municipality to start providing broadband in their community if they meet a number of requirements, which we have learned over the years that those requirements have really acted as a barrier to some of these small municipalities being able to provide broadband. Reedsburg comes to mind, mm-hmm, as an example of just a really progressive municipality who was able to get this done. And what we had proposed in the governor's budget was that we relax some of those requirements. And it's similar to how we electrified rural America, right? I mean, mm-hmm, over 100 years ago, it was the same situation when it came to getting electricity to the hardest to reach places in America. We turned to the rural co-ops to help build that last quarter mile. And that's, in my opinion, that's the type of innovation and that's the type of tool that we need here as well, to try and make it easier for local municipalities to provide service. And it's not to push out the big internet service providers. I will say that during the pandemic, especially, we saw the larger internet service providers step up in a very big way. But at the end of the day, there are still gaps in the state where the private internet service providers have said they're not willing to go because the return on investment isn't there. So in my mind, that's where we as a state should be stepping in to help fill those gaps.
We're talking with Rebecca Cameron-Vock, who is chairperson of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. What questions do you have about the PSC, how it works? What do you want the chairperson to know about utilities? And as a ratepayer, 800-642-1234. Tom is joining us from Viroqua. Hi, Tom. What is your question?
Yes. Good morning, Commissioner Vock and Ms. Biscamp. In 2005, under Act 142, the administration of the ratepayer-funded public benefits program was assigned to the Public Service Commission. But since then, the PSC has relinquished most decision-making and administration of the programs to the statewide Energy Efficiency and Renewables Administration, CERA, which is made up totally of utility executives and operates with no public input and no obligations to Wisconsin's open meetings laws. CERA has in turn awarded contracts for most of the operations of the Focus on Energy program to large out-of-state entities. How does this arrangement fulfill the initial goals of the state in-state public-private alliance that was the original intent of the legislature?
That's a great question. And I'm sure, as you know, we're celebrating the 20th anniversary of the Focus on Energy program this year. And so you're correct. When state law was rewritten, it required the establishment of the board of CERA as a board. And that board does include representation from utility companies. However, it also includes representation from other entities, including the PSC. In terms of how the programs, the energy efficiency programs, are designed and how they are implemented, the PSC still does, in fact, have jurisdiction over the implementation of the programs, but more importantly, over the planning of those programs. It's called the quadrennial planning process. And what we do it at the PSC. We do it as part of our open meetings. And it is always available for comment by members of the public. And then we deliberate in an open meeting after providing notice of that meeting. And the three of us talk about how we think the Focus on Energy programs should be designed. And it's meant to really allow for flexibility in energy efficiency programs so that we are able to build on past successes. And we are able to make tweaks or changes when we see that a certain type of program maybe isn't getting the traction that we originally thought it would get, or that it's not achieving energy savings at the level that we were hoping for. So, you know, currently Focus continues to partner with nearly 110 utilities across the state. And we do know from an independent study by the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab that Wisconsin's Focus on Energy program is the most cost-effective program in the nation. And for me, it absolutely continues to underscore the fact that investments in energy efficiency are the lowest cost way to avoid having to construct additional generation or transmission. And we're really fortunate that our Focus on Energy here in Wisconsin returns $4.80 for every dollar we invest. And those are economic benefits, they're environmental benefits, and of course, energy savings, because energy efficiency has the effect of driving energy costs down.
So. When we come back, we're going to look at that program in regards to solar and what has happened there. Rebecca Cameron-Vock is chair of the Wisconsin PSC Public Service Commission. What utility challenges does your community face? How do you want the PSC to address it? What do you want the PSC to prioritize or take on with utilities? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with PSC Chair Rebecca Cameron-Vock here on the Ideas Network. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing issues before the PSC that affect homeowners, that affect renters, small businesses with utility costs. What questions do you have about Wisconsin's transition to clean energy? Do you support how the Public Service Commission and energy companies have progressed? What effect are utility costs on your overall budget and your energy burden? 800-642-1234. Rebecca Cameron Vock is chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission, and she's with us for about 9 more minutes. Mark is joining us from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Mark. What is on your mind?
Well, I've called in on this before, but I wonder how the Public Service Commission supports Focus on Energy that gives us a kickback or a payment for installing solar panel systems, which I did, but then allows my utility company to charge me extra every month for having the solar panels. This seems paradoxical.
Mark, thank you. Commissioner, what can you say about that?
Sure. So there are absolutely incentives for the installation of rooftop solar, and then each utility has its own tariffs as it relates to customer-sited solar, or customer-sited any type of generation, really, customer-owned generating systems. And so we review those tariffs specific to each individual utility. And when and if there are concerns about the way that those rates are written, we look to comments from customers and members of the public. That becomes a part of the record, and it becomes a part of our deliberations when we look at each utility's specific rate.
Yeah, but what are the market limitations for solar panels? Is rooftop solar worth the energy savings for homeowners, especially lower-income households?
I think that we're seeing a lot more interest and a lot of studies being done on the access of solar panels for low to moderate income families. And beyond income, it's where your house is or if you're in a house. If you are renting, then your ability to take solar energy becomes a little more complicated, right? So you would have to be in a service territory where community solar is offered as an option, or you would have to sign up for a utility company's green pricing tariff, where they commit that your load would be using only renewable sources of energy. But it is complicated, and we understand that it's an issue. And it's something that we're looking at as it relates to lower to moderate income families.
Looking more broadly at utility rates, last month we were talking with Tom Content, who heads up the Citizens Utility Board, and told us that both We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service do not plan to raise utility rates in the next year.
From a bottom line for ratepayers, it's good to see these things when you can push off any increase, especially during a pandemic, that's a good thing. So we're still waiting and to see what gets filed by the other three main utilities, Xcel, Alliant, and Madison Gas and Electric.
Commissioner, how long will these rates stay in place? I mean, what can we expect here?
So we can expect that for the WEC utilities, that's We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service, they are going to stay out. So they wouldn't have new rates in effect until the beginning of 2023 at the earliest. We also received a notice of an intent to settle a case by Alliance Utility that was filed last week. So I think as we look ahead, we're seeing that, yes, there is the promise of holding rates steady for the next year, the next 2 years. But we have to also keep in mind that there's capital dollars that are being spent as well, right? So we know that there are new solar farms that we have approved at the commission, and we know that those come with a capital cost. So at some point, I'm expecting that we will see all of the major investor-owned utilities come in to adjust rates.
Yeah, what are your concerns still as you look at how to regulate solar energy and you green light these projects, you know, like a battery storage project in Dane County for renewable energy?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's incredibly exciting and it's incredibly complicated, right? The transition from the traditional baseload generating facility has now morphed into smaller projects from a megawatt standpoint.
Mm.
And the increase of battery storage, as you indicated, you know, we've got about 200 megawatts of battery storage in the queue right now that's planning to be built in Wisconsin. And it's a relatively new technology for us here in Wisconsin. I think it's fantastic that we have approved nearly 1,500 megawatts of new solar. But as I indicated, that also comes with a cost. And so we have to pay special attention to what the impact on customer rates is going to be as we see coal facilities being retired early and the influx of new generation projects being built. We have to come up with ways to try and mitigate the rate impact on customers.
We're talking with Rebecca Cameron Bach, who is chairperson of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. I want to land here on water and water infrastructure. You know, there's a lot of issues when it comes to water, like PFAS and replacing lead pipes and preventing nitrate pollution and pollution from ag runoff. What is the state of water infrastructure and what role can the PSC have in cleaning up water in our state?
We know that our water infrastructure is aging, right? And we know that there's been a lot of deferred maintenance done on our water infrastructure. We do have a lead service line program at the PSC, and that allows for utilities to come in and put in front of us a program that would allow customers to have assistance from their water utilities to pay for their side of a lead service line. We've seen that operate very successfully in about 8 communities. We anticipate receiving more applications as it relates to lead service lines. We also are really active at the national level looking at affordability. Water affordability hasn't been something that has garnered a lot of attention over the years, but we know that together with their heating, their electricity costs, that water costs are an important input into a household utility burden. And it's something that we are paying much closer attention to now as we know that upgrades need to happen to the water infrastructure in order to ensure clean drinking water.
Commissioner, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Rebecca Cameron Bach is chair of the 3-member Public Service Commission. Just ahead, we explore why LGBTQIA plus people are especially vulnerable to discrimination in healthcare and what can be done. What can be done to improve access with a family nurse practitioner? I'm Kate Archer Kent. This is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.